Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 26 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we take a wild trip through the 1987 John Hughes comedy Planes, Trains, and Automobiles 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today, and hopefully this entire week, is Jim O'Kane of the Rocketeer Minute, the Apollo 13 Minute, and lots and lots and lots and lots of other Minute shows, including a few that have a lot of people on them. So we'll probably talk about those sometime during the week. So welcome to the show, Jim.
Okay, thanks, Rob. Thank you very much for having me over. This is an interesting movie to I would never have thought of being part of this. I have I am now, this may be surprising, but I'm not a big John Hughes fan. I've seen this movie a bunch of times, but I never thought anybody would ever ask me about it. So this will be an interesting week, I hope.
Well, isn't that part of the whole idea of doing movies by minutes, that you can even discuss movies that you don't like as much?
Yeah, actually, sometimes they come up with better content when you're talking about movies that you're not fond of, or things that, well, you know, and it gives you ideas of what to pick apart and what to how you could figure out how to make it a better movie.
Right.
The thing that I do have to say positively about John Hughes is he does know his audience. He knows what his audience likes, and he was able to churn out a bunch of films that people responded to, and
right. Yeah,
that is a plus for John Hughes.
And well, this movie, as you know, and everyone else knows, is a unique John Hughes movie because it's not one that's geared towards teenagers. This is more of an adult type of John Hughes film. Even though I guess you could say Vacation is also an adult movie, also, but this is one of the humor is not teenage humor. Let's put it that way.
I agree. Yeah.
It's highbrow type of humor.
Yeah, in between, and it does have slapstick in it too. But I think it is not aimed at his typical target audience of Gen Xers, or at the time where teenagers or young adults.
Right.
So yeah, it definitely goes that way. But he did manage to capture that. I think some of the I think the audience that was watching things like The Breakfast Club or Ferris Bueller would probably stay around for this film.
Yeah, the question is whether all of those teenagers would get this movie as well as they get the other ones.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, this is geared towards a completely different audience.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's so much information that we've already discussed over the last few weeks that would probably shock you. Did you know that the original first cut of this movie was nearly 4 hours?
Yeah, I had read that, and I was like, I can't imagine 4 hours of this. It would just be an ordeal after a while. I mean, it is a bit of a single joke movie of, here's a man with a series of calamities befall him, and you're watching him struggle through this again and again and again, and just, rinse and repeat on all the on the jokes coming out of that. It's like, oh, isn't it awful? He's in a bad hotel. He's lost his luggage. He's had stuff stolen from him. And it just, it continues on and on. But that is typical of John Hughes' writing. I mean, Ferris Bueller's Day Off is much like it's almost a cartoon thing that you have a gag, mm-hmm. and then it's repeated again and again.
Right.
I think
he varies the gag a little
bit.
Oh, it's not the same exact gag each and every time.
Yeah. It worked for the Roadrunner and the Coyote. So I'd say this is about the same idea that if you have something that works, do it 20 times and your audience will stay for it. So, but yeah, four hours, I think that would try even the best John Hughes fan.
Yeah. I have to admit, as much as I love this movie, and I've always been curious to see the 4 hour cut, but now that I've read the script, and in every episode, I also mention the differences in the script because they actually did film the entire script. So there's tons of stuff that was cut out, and most of what they cut out helps make this a better movie.
Yeah. I agree.
Because as you said, it's the same joke over and over. They sometimes stretch things a little too much.
Yeah,
but there still are some great stuff in the script, which is why I keep talking about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And brevity is the soul of wit. And I think Hughes was, he trusted in getting out the razor blade and cutting the film down, which is a hard thing to do when you've come up with something. You think, oh, this is a great line, I don't want to lose it. But if it makes the story stronger, then you do that.
Yeah,
I think if we can get a little bit into the minute that we're talking about here with.
Yeah, of course we are. That's what we're here for. So minute 26 starts with Neil continuing his diatribe against Dell and goes all the way till Dell begins to try and defend himself. So, I mean, this entire minute and pretty much this entire week, except for I think Friday, is the two of them arguing the entire time, right? So we have some great dialogue that, from the research that I did, this is pretty much all ad-libbed because it's not in the script.
Yeah, and they're both great improvisational actors to pull this out. If anybody could do it, these two, you know, Steve Martin, king of one-liners and ad-libs, and John Candy is perfect in his reactions. I mean, he's really mastering the scene here, even though he doesn't say anything. He just, you know, he's mostly reacting to this vitriol that Steve Martin is spewing.
Completely.
And I think this minute to me shows the major weakness of the film. The major weakness in this film is the miscasting of Steve Martin. I think Steve Martin playing the straight man was a mistake. I don't think, I mean, we've seen him in other straight man roles, but he's, you don't get the feeling that he has that kind of vitriol in him. He can do it in a humorous way, but here it's just straight out anger and just being mean. He's trying to hurt Del Griffith's character. You know, Del Griffith.
Okay, I definitely agree with you on that. But part of the whole thing in this whole movie is he has a great arc. This is one of the few scenes where he's this mean. You know, he is mean in a few other places along the way, but he realizes pretty quickly that he doesn't need to be mean. You know, and things change along the way with that.
Yeah, and it's playing Martin much against his type. We picture him as happy-go-lucky. I mean, he does do slow burns. I think of, you know, other films he's been in, like Bowfinger, where he's been put down upon. But he has an internal optimism, which is lacking here. You don't see this optimism in him for most of the movie until he finally, you know, well, we don't want to get further into the film. But, I mean, he does have a transformation toward the end. But I still think it's not Steve Martin's strongest point in being the heavy, the bad guy in this thing.
Okay, I can accept that. I mean, there's also stuff that's in the original script that was filmed that they cut out, which also causes part of the reason why he actually acts the way that he does. I mean, there's a whole subplot that was completely cut out that he's in a very, very deep rift with his wife. Every time they're on the phone, they get into arguments and she keeps hanging up on him and she keeps yelling at him and she believes that he's making this all up, that he was really not stuck, you know, and things like that.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the problems with editing a movie down so much. I mean, to edit a movie down almost 2.5 hours, so there's still stuff that there's still residual aspects of the original cut that are here that make it a little more difficult if you don't know that information. You know, if you know that this is maybe part of the background of this character, then you might accept it a little more.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, it's true in most movies that when you lose an entire character, or, you know, not an entire character, but if you lose...
You pretty much do. She's not, Susan's not in the movie very much.
Yeah, which probably really, really hurt that actress a bit. I mean, I imagine being, you know, telling everybody you're in a Steve Martin, John Candy movie, and it's like, yeah, there's my 30 seconds. Here I go. And here I am at the top of the stairs. And, you know, that's that.
And I get to smile and I get to get angry on the phone. That's all I get to do.
Yeah. I, one time I had interviewed a woman named Mary Linda Rapley. She was, she's an actress. And she had, you probably know her if you watch the original series of Star Trek. She played, Chekhov's hippie girlfriend on the Way to Eden episode.
Okay.
And she was back in the 60s. She was in the movie In Cold Blood. She was big, not big, but she was on her way up. And she was going to be in a Gregory Peck movie. She was in John Sturges' production of Marooned, Columbia Pictures in 1970.
Okay.
And she got the role of Gregory Peck's daughter. And Gregory Peck in the movie is the mission controller of a doomed flight of an Apollo spacecraft that's stuck in orbit and people are going to die and they're trying to figure out some way to save them. And Gregory Peck comes across through the whole thing. He goes through all these explanations about why it costs too much and they can't send up a rescue mission because there's just not enough time to go save them. And they're just going to have to write off three astronauts. And the whole movie, he just sounds like a monster through the whole thing in telling people. And the screenwriter put in this one scene with his daughter, Gregory Peck's daughter, Mary Linda Rapaly, meets him at an airport in Houston, and she has a brief discussion with him, and she said, "You are going to do everything to save them, aren't you?" And he looks at her and he said, "We have to." And it would, you know, it changes his
whole personality.
What he's like. He's not a. So they decided the scene wasn't really necessary, and they cut it for time. So she's listed in the credits, but she's not in the movie. And I talked with her about that, and she said, "You know, for a week and a half, I got to play Gregory Peck's daughter. I was somebody." And she was telling all of her friends, and then they went to see the movie, and it's like, "Where's your scene?" And oh, you know, so
I guess it's like Kevin Costner in The Big Chill, you know.
Exactly. You know, you did see his wrist, so that was a help. But I guess that's just part of the business.
Well, she could probably be happy that she got paid.
Director's cut. You know. yeah, she is. She said everything wound up cutting room floor, and she's never seen the scene. But she, after that movie, she got holiday cards. Every December, she got cards from the Peck family to my Hollywood daughter, and you know, it's just very sweet. So, at least she got a friendship of Gregory Peck with her, which is that's nice.
So basically, the diatribe that Neil started yesterday. Where he reaches the point where he starts talking about suicide and things like that, and then he starts talking about being in an insurance seminar, and he basically says, "I could tolerate any insurance seminar for days. I can sit there and listen to them go on and on with a big smile on my face. They'd say, 'How can you stand it?' And I'd say," and that's the way the minute on Friday ended. And today we continue with that, where he says, "'Cause I've been with Del Griffith. I can take anything." You know what they'd say? They'd say, "I know what you mean." The shower curtain ring guy. "It's like going on a date with a chatty Kathy doll. I expect you to have a little string on your chest, you know, that you pull out and have it snap back. Except I wouldn't pull it out and snap it back. You would." And he has this very awkward sound as he's doing the motions, which, again, that is perfect Steve Martin to be able to do that type of what would you call it? He's able to do a mime act basically by pulling the string by the way that he's doing it. And then he says, "And by the way, you know, when you're telling those little stories, here's an idea, have a point." It makes it so much more interesting for the listener. And at this point, we actually get Del's response where he says, "You want to hurt me? Go right ahead. If it makes you feel any better, I'm an easy target." And then he says, "Yeah, you're right." So, I mean, that's pretty much all the dialogue we have here. But this dialogue tells us so much about these characters. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, Steve Martin isn't necessarily the actor that you're going to think of as being a mean person. You know, I guess you can sort of say the same thing with Tom Hanks. If you were to put Tom Hanks in this scene also, he would feel very out of place by being mean to someone else. And so Steve Martin fits into that category. I completely agree with you about it. And I think that they do take things a little too far here, but it still works.
Given that, who would you cast in the Steve Martin role?
That's a very, very good question. And I always try and keep myself from looking for other people to cast in roles, because again, I love this movie. And I think that the dynamic and the chemistry between Steve Martin and John Candy works so well. I mean, I know that the role of John Candy originally was supposed to be played by either John Goodman or John Travolta. I know those were two of the names that were thrown out. And I think Tom Hanks, if I remember correctly, I think Tom Hanks was also supposedly up for the role of Neil. I'm trying to remember from my notes from weeks ago when we discussed that.
I would have put, I mean, I know they wanted A-list actors, but I would have brought in, well, I mean, one A-list actor I could think of would be Dabney Coleman. I think would have worked as an actor here, because he plays good frustration, and I think having a revelation, this transformation, I think that would have worked with him to a lesser extent in a considering it's a John Hughes movie, he could have gone into his stable of characters and brought Paul Gleason on board. Paul Gleason in the Breakfast Club as the teacher who got stuck with the Saturday detention. I could see Paul Gleason being able to come across as acerbic, and also being able to have that change of heart in there. There's so many opportunities that of being like David Warner might have been a good choice here too. David Warner can play comedy, but also be rotten to the core, you know. Or even Michael Caine would have worked if you want to go, you know, if you think of like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, think of Michael Caine's turn in that.
Right. Okay. I mean, I think you please. They're all great actors, but I don't think any of them would have been able to bring what Steve Martin brings here, because Steve Martin really knows how to toe the line with this character, and you can feel so much for him. He fits in as this executive. I don't know if Michael Caine would have fit in as this type of executive. He might have been able to do part of the comedy and part of the meanness that you need to do here, but I still, it's hard for me to picture anyone else in this role.
Okay, yeah. I mean, these are all just basically what ifs. I mean, I picture, like, would Bill Murray have worked? He might. I mean, we saw Bill Murray being this kind of a character in Groundhog Day.
Right. And Scrooge.
Yeah, and Scrooge. He can be the rotten guy. Yeah, again, this is where we're at, and this is, you know, you can't really go.
Yeah, this movie was made 35 years ago. There is rumors that they're working on a remake with Will Smith and I think Kevin Hart, which I really hope they don't do. I mean, they're both great actors, but I don't think they could do justice to this type of movie.
And it's like comedy is, you know, lightning in a bottle. I don't think you can do it again. There's other people write stuff. Why not? You know, it's understood that there's so much money at stake with these movies that you have to go with a sure thing. And that's why you remake things. Even if they're not great, then they're going to bring in some cash.
That's true.
But it's
especially now in COVID, you know, you're not going to be able to bring in that much cash in the theaters.
Yeah, exactly. And so
for something like this,
hopefully they probably turn this into a Netflix 6-part series.
Why only 6 parts?
Yeah, sure.
you can stretch it out to 13. Who knows?
Yeah, we'll save it for season 2.
So, right. Exactly. So one of the things that was interesting in Neil's diatribe is the fact that he mentions Chatty Cathy.
Yes.
Okay. Now I'm sure you know who or what Chatty Cathy
was. I am of an age where I knew kids with Chatty Cathys. And I think people now know them as they are valuable. They're valuable in the classic toy category. We're about the same age. They're about 60 years old now. And it might not have been the original, but it was one of the first string pull talking dolls. It was invented by the same the handlers, the same people that invented the Barbie doll. So
very good. Wow. And you're that's impressive. Wait, did you look this up or you knew this?
No, I'm old. I remember. I just remember. I know Mattel was the handlers. What was her name? Ruth Handler. Ruth Handler.
Yes. And Ruth and Elliot Handler.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Ruth. And I think they say and Elliot, but it was actually Ruth did most of the work on this stuff. Elliot was just kind of like the guy that had to be with her because it was 1960 and they didn't believe that the woman would be able to come up with this great idea for a product. But Mattel,
right.
Mattel just, you know, conquered the world back around 1960. And I think, well, Barbie dolls came out first, but then Chatty Cathy came out, and it's basically you pull the string, and inside was this little, as I was present at many dissections of Chatty Cathy dolls. She had two screws in her shoulders, and if you unscrewed the back, there was this small plastic cartridge, and it had a, I'm moving my hands like we're doing this as a video, but there was a small, it was a piece of vinyl that would stretch out. Well, there were two versions. One had like a little phonograph record, and another one that was a little piece of vinyl that stretched out that a needle would go through. And this coil, when you pulled the string, it would pull the coil tight, and then when you let it go, the coil would unwind onto another reel over basically a phonograph needle and a little plastic speaker. And so she would say different things, and there were like 5 or 6 tracks on the
11.
11. Oh, okay. I didn't. You, and when you pulled on the string, the needle would jump and land on a different track. So you would play these things. And we had that would be the first thing that would break would be the vinyl. So and they didn't have replacement vinyl. So after that, you had silent, you know, not so chatty Kathy. This and the reason that they had the two screws so easily available was the second thing besides the vinyl breaking. If you had to unscrew it, because if you little kids would pull the string too hard and rip the string out. So, you know, you have to get your dad to come in and unscrew it and get a piece of string and tie it on there and then find something that would hold it on the other side. It was really hard to thread. I remember that through the middle of where her belly button would be. So, that was my personal recollections of Chatty Cathy.
I did a little bit of research. Okay. So I can expand a little on what you said here. You said a lot of what I have here. So first of all, it was first produced by Ruth and Elliot Handler in 1959, and they sold it for 6 years. Okay, it was released in stores starting in 1960, and they sold them for $18 in 1960. Okay, it was the second most popular,
which was a lot of money back then.
It was the second most popular doll of the 1960s after Barbie, which was, as you mentioned earlier, also made by Mattel. Okay, they have a simple phonograph record inside the cavity behind the doll's abdomen, and that's how it would work, as you explained about the metal coil and the string. And
yeah, it was a real Rube Goldberg kind of contraption, but it was amazing that it worked. And they would eventually put those same ones would go into the talking G.I. Joe dolls, only about half the size when you open them up. But the only two I can remember was like Chatty Cathy would tell you I love you, and then she'd say I hurt myself. So she's very emotional about everything. Yeah. I love you. I hurt myself. I love you.
And so here I'll go through the 11 phrases that they had there. Oh. It's where are we going? Please carry me. Let's change my dress. Please brush my hair. I got hurt. I'm all tired. Will you play with me? Let's play house. I love you. I'm hungry, and tell me a story.
Wow.
Okay, those are the 11 ones. Now, a few years later, they added another 7 phrases. I unfortunately wasn't able to find all of them. I found that they added Let's Play School and May I Have a Cookie. Those are two of the 7 that I know were not. Now, do you know who did the voice for Chatty Cathy?
The voice sounded for whoever did. I think she sounded exactly like Cindy Lou Who on was it June Foray?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, she sounded like June Foray.
because it was June Foray.
Cindy Lou Who in that was what was weird watching How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Whenever Cindy Lou Who came out, it's like, wait, that's Hattie Cathy. So, it was June Foray. Oh, good. I did not know that. Wow. But yeah.
And also, she also did the voice for Rocky from Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yep, that's right. Yeah.
And she was very well known for doing a lot of cartoon characters throughout the 40s all the way up to the mid 2000s.
Yeah. She'd do the witch that was on all the Warner Brothers cartoons that would run off and then her hairpins would stay in the air while she ran off. But yeah, she's a very, very familiar voice to kids my age.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm surprised they didn't have one that when you pulled the string, it said, go buy some more Mattel toys. It was
only when this one broke.
Yeah. I think they sold like a Chatty Cathy baby carriage that you could buy that would, you'd sit her in. It would say Chatty Cathy on the sides of the baby carriage. They had like, you know how Barbie had a whole different ensembles. They also had different, like, well, that one that they said, you know, I need to get change my clothes. They sold outfits that were, they had little, they came in a box and it was like a little hanger, and you could actually get a closet to put Chatty Cathy's clothes in, a little
cardboard. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. They really knew how to.
Accessories not included.
Yeah, yeah. They really, and considering the thing never needed batteries, that was pretty impressive.
Yeah. But now, one of the other things that I found out we're here is that they use the same technology for the CNC toys. Now, those I remember.
Oh, yeah.
I grew up in the 70s, and so I remember those.
Yeah, the cow says moo thing.
Exactly, the cow says moo. Okay. So they had the animal sounds where you pull the string, and then it moves around, and wherever it lands, so it says the animal and the sound they made. They also had the B says C and say, which recited different letters of the alphabet. And at this point, they reached The thing that was good about it was in the original ones, they didn't need batteries, right? And the sound was produced by a simple low fidelity phonograph record that was driven by a metal coil wound by pulling the toy string, okay, which is obviously the same mechanism that they used for the Chatty Cathy dials, okay? And a whole bunch of movies and TV shows, they would have all of these different toys that were using the same type of thing until they reached a point where they changed it and decided to use a lever instead of having you pull a string. You know, you'd pull a lever and then it would spin around.
That's right. The farmer's one, the cow says thing. I remember that had a lever along the side of it.
Yeah.
But it started out with the older ones had the pull string on the back.
Right. And then they eventually moved on to battery operated ones, which were slightly different from what they had on the early ones. Instead of pulling the string, you would push it, and that would release and make the toy talk. And because it was battery operated, they could actually recite longer phrases than the little one saying "I love you." You know, there were things that there were a lot longer phrases that they were able to say. And it basically reached the point where they were just everything turned into levers. And one of the reasons that they changed it to the lever was there was actually a little girl from Rhode Island that unfortunately became blind because the string snapped and hit her in the eye. So after a lawsuit, they decided to change things and make a uniform design of just using levers instead of the string. I mean, it's surprising that it took 30 years for someone to lose an eye from that.
Yeah, but it happened in Rhode Island. That's Mattel's backyard. I mean, they're right in Rhode Island, so I guess I used to live just on the border of Rhode Island, and I used to work in Providence, and everybody in it's a bit of a cliche, but everybody in Rhode Island knows everybody else in Rhode Island. So I think this was it hit home because they probably knew somebody who knew. Yeah. But wow, that's amazing. And yeah, it's, I didn't realize growing up that would be such a revolution of, that Chatty Cathy would change Mattel's entire industry with, I mean, I had,
well, I'm assuming the Hansons didn't think that either.
the Hansons were, Barbie dolls were everywhere, but Chatty Cathy at the time was very popular. Every little girl my age had a Chatty Cathy of some kind. I know they had knockoffs. I don't know.
Yeah, they had a whole bunch of different types that throughout the years. Yeah. I decided not to go into too much detail about that. it's less interesting to us. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But I mean, one of the things that I liked about this minute is, as you mentioned at the beginning, the reactions of both Neil and Del to the things that the other one says. You know, we see that Del is clearly hurt by the things that Neil is saying to him. And when Del responds, we see that Neil realizes that he went too far.
Yeah, and the cinematography here is pretty impressive because both shots of the men are straight on. They're directly looking at each other. I mean, it's not first person, but it's pretty close to first person where they're staring at each other. And the reaction shot when they cut back to John Candy is very heartfelt. You feel for him, like you hear he's been dressed down by this guy and he doesn't mean to be obnoxious,
but that's the way it comes out. All right. Do you have anything else for this minute before we move on to the other segments?
No, it's an impressive minute, and it really gets down to the skills of both actors. So it's a very, very nice minute. If you're gonna do a shorthand of how this movie works and what are the strengths of these actors, this is the perfect minute.
Yeah, especially given the fact that this was all ad-libbed. You know, makes you wonder how many times they had to redo this scene in order to just get it right. I wonder if they got it the first time.
pity the poor editor who has to fit them all together. It's like, well, we can use this for take three and this from take seven, and just hopefully the conversation still makes sense.
That's true. So in the original script, there is no changes from the scene because the scene doesn't appear in the original script because of the fact that it's ad-libbed. Wow. So every Monday we do a short little segment called Martin Monday, where my guest will actually give us his top five performances of Steve Martin. Now, Jim has already given us a little bit of a hint that he's not the biggest Steve Martin fan. So it's going to be interesting to see what your five.
Oh, I would say no. I am not a Steve Martin fan. I love his work. I think he's a great, especially his writing. If you ever read any of his writings, all the way back from his Painful Shoes books and things, he's a great writer.
He's a great screenwriter also. He does have some great movies that he's written.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. And you know, and he's also shown his directing chops in other films. So I think, and starting out as a writer on the Smothers Brothers summer show back in the 60s, I mean, he wrote some really clever stuff, a lot of stuff for Pat Paul. I mean, I know I'm talking with a lot of the audience who's never watched some of these things, because I was a kid at the time watching him, but yeah, I was going through what I like most in Steve Martin's career, at least on screen. And let's start with the number five.
Yeah.
I'll go. Mm-hmm. We'll have a countdown. Number five. I loved him in. By the way, his partnership with Carl Reiner, I think, was his high point. He did The Jerk and things like that with Carl Reiner. But he did a bunch of successful movies. One of the ones, number five, that I'm talking about is All of Me.
Oh, I love that movie.
And it's so, now there is where he comes across being frustrated, and the ability he in the movie. He winds up with the soul of dying old lady Lily.
No, she
Tomlin
died.
In
she
him,
died.
And she died. Yeah, yeah, and like he gets her soul dumped into him, and he has to play roles where he is two people in one body, and he has this thing where he's walking down a street after he gets turned in, and just watching him drag himself along as if he's two people was astonishing.
Yeah, his physicality there's no question about how amazing that is.
And being able to just express his frustration was perfect in that film. I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Another number four. It's kind of tied because it's really the same character. When he was in the 1978 film, the Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, he played Maxwell of Maxwell's Silver Hammer, and he only has like about a 3-minute role in it. He pretty much redid that when you watch Little Shop of Horrors, being the dentist. He's just this horrible guy, and he's enjoying singing. And he sings, you know, the lyrics of Maxwell Silver Hammer, that he kills people with a hammer. But he just does it with such glee when he's talking about stuff in the film, and just completely overacts the scene when he's – and it is a musical, but he's just – it's perfect over-the-top performance. And even though he's only in it briefly, it's one of the highlights of that movie. Number three, of course, I would say the Carl Reiner film, The Jerk, spot on. He does just such a great job, and working out all the gags with Carl Reiner, who had such an experience with, you know, people like Sid Caesar working on the Dick Van Dyke Show and things like that. It's like, it's a great broad comedy, slapstick, and beautiful callbacks in it. I think that really The Jerk is what really puts Steve Martin in the role of a major motion picture star.
Yeah.
My one that isn't mentioned enough, I think, is another Carl Reiner film that he did with Universal, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, which is an homage to hard-boiled detective films, but done as a comedy. Steve Martin and Rachel Ward and Carl Reiner are in the film. Very clever idea, similar to what Woody Allen did with Zelig, and taking old stock footage, in this case Hollywood movies, and placing himself in like an A-B shot where he's talking with people like Bogart or Alan Ladd or Ray Milland, and he's in a 1940s movie, shot in black and white. Very clever use of all the tropes of hardboiled detective films. So I just enjoy that very much. My number one film, the film that I enjoy the most of Steve Martin, and one of which I've considered in the past of making a Movies by Minute project about it, is I love movies about movies. And my favorite Steve Martin film is Bowfinger, from directed by Frank Oz, Yoda himself, and it stars Steve Martin and Eddie Murphy. Steve Martin is a struggling movie producer and wannabe director who he tries to make a movie with a big name star. At the time, it would be Eddie Murphy playing another big name star. Eddie Murphy doesn't want to be in his film, but through a series of subterfuge and con games, Steve Martin and his gang of production people could cajole Eddie Murphy into acting in their move in his movie by filming him secretly and just getting his reactions and dropping him in. It's a very funny film. If you haven't seen it, I'd strongly recommend watching this. This is a real P, and it was also written by Steve Martin, and it's very much top of his game, both in acting and writing. Very funny cast of characters and clever takes on everything from Hollywood rental shops to Scientology, and well worth seeing.
All right, great. Thank you very much for that top five. So the other segment that we do every day is the Off the Beaten Track segment, where either myself or my guest will tell a little anecdotal story of misadventure or adventure of something that happened to us along the way, which obviously fits in really well with this whole diatribe from Steve Martin, where he's talking about the anecdotes have to have a point. So hopefully you have a nice story for us, Jim.
Yeah, I don't have one on, well, actually I do have one on planes. No trains are involved, but there is an automobile at the end, but it's a very tiny automobile. My first flight on an aircraft, I was 7 years old. I was Boxing Day, the day after Christmas in 1967. My parents and I flew to Bermuda from New York. And we stayed at a hotel that no longer exists now called the Castle Harbor Hotel. And it really wasn't much things to do for kids there, but they had, at the time, Bermuda is a British colony and it's a British Commonwealth now, but it was very British. They had afternoon tea and all kinds of things, lots of stuff for grownups. But when I was a 7 year old, there really wasn't much for the little kids to do. But my dad noticed in a shop in the, in this Castle Harbor Hotel, there's a shop that sold little toys, and one of them were matchbox cars. Everybody's, you know, played with matchbox cars. And back in the 60s, matchbox cars were a big deal. For 50 cents, you could get yourself a little Jeep or a truck full of cattle or a tractor and things like that. So anyway, my dad bought a couple of these things so I could, you know, run them along the railings in the lobby and stuff. And I was playing with these things. I was sitting in a chair in the lobby, and I was running them along a shelf, and a man came by and picked up one of my little matchbox cars, and he turned to someone that was with him, and he said, "You know, no matter where I go, I can't get away from these things." And my dad was sitting next to me, and my dad introduced himself and said, I'm Jim O'Kane. I'm a junior. So he shook his hand. And the man said, I'm Leslie Smith. And it turned out Leslie Smith was one half of, he and his friend Rodney Smith took their first names and smashed them together and invented a company called Lesney, which went up against Dinky Toys and Corgi and built matchbox cars. And this guy was the head of the matchbox company.
Wow.
And, here I was playing with something that he had invented. And, he was the largest manufacturer of automobiles in the United Kingdom. Of course they were all about, 2 inches long, but, he worked with another fellow who came up with these ideas because his daughter was upset because she could take toys to school, but they had to fit within inside of a matchbox. So he built cars that would fit inside of a matchbox, and that, hence the name and the company. And
wow.
it grew up huge. And after I met him, the year after he became in competition with Mattel, as we're bringing this back full circle, Mattel came out with Hot Wheels, which were, instead of having solid plastic, they had hollow plastic and they could go faster on a track. And it really put a dent in Matchbox's sales. Eventually they came out with their own line of hollow wheeled cars and went up against them. But Mattel beat Matchbox. Matchbox, I think, sold out to a Hong Kong company in the end of the 20th century sometime. But there I was meeting at the time I did not know it, but he was he was knighted by the Queen. He was Sir Leslie Smith OBE, and that was my brush with fame, Mr. Matchbox, and all about a plane and an automobile.
Cool. That is such a great story. Thank you very much for that. So you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you or where they can find you?
You can actually, as we speak, even now, I am, along with 25 other Movies by Minutes hosts, are doing a group project. This is our fifth group project. We're doing the Silverado Minute, where we discuss the 1985 Lawrence Kasdan directed feature with Kevin Kline and Scott Glenn and Kevin Costner. All the Kevins were in that movie. I don't think Kevin James was in it, but we do these as kind of a sampler of Movies by Minute hosts that each group gets 1 week. And we have a lot of people on board, and hopefully, if you've been wondering about the Movies by Minutes process, tune in and you can hear how different people approach the same movie from different directions. And that's it. You can find that on, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're probably getting this podcast, you can probably find our podcast. So check that out. It's also at the big site, SilveradoMinute.com.
Wow, that sounds really fascinating. Maybe I should check that out too. People are gonna have to wait a long time till they hear me on that one. My weeks come in a few months from now, so
they'll be here, and they're good ones, I'm sure.
I think so. Let's hope other people do too. All right. So, and to find me, you can go and just do a quick search anywhere for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Twitter, on Facebook, or you can go to our website. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher that might be using to listen to this show. So until tomorrow, you're
fucked. Yep, basically, you're fucked.